My dear friend, I know of no medicine fit to diminish the violent natural inclinations you mention, and if I did, I think I should not communicate it to you. Marriage is the proper remedy. It is the most natural state of man, and therefore the state in which you are most likely to find solid happiness. Those are the words of Benjamin Franklin. Welcome to the show. My name is Ben.
Oh, Benny Frank.
No relation.
No, none. Well, you know, you're sort of spiritual successors.
That's very weird. I at least have better hair, if not a better position in American politics.
That's true. But you're also, like Ben Franklin, a bit of a forward-thinking innovator, Ben.
Oh, thank you so much, Noel. I sincerely appreciate that. They do, in some places, call me the less cool super producer, Casey Pegram. Which I take as, you know, I treat it as the significant compliment that it is.
Well, it's because Casey Pegram is the bar.
Right.
And it's a very high one.
And very few people ever meet that bar.
Yeah, but you're like one click below the bar.
Oh, no, too kind.
Just one click.
Man's reach must exceed his grasp, else what's a heaven for?
Did Ben Franklin say that?
No, that was Robert Browning, the poet Robert Browning.
Ah, yes.
Yes.
Robert Browning. Well, here's the thing about Ben Franklin. We know him as one of the founding fathers of these fine United States. He was a part of the Second Continental Congress and was sort of like this he was a really good diplomat in that he kind of smoothed over some of the tensions between the other founding fathers. He kind of acted as like a little bit of a lubricant, if you will, a human lubricant. He was also an inventor, and he published a Poor Richard's Almanac, where he espoused the virtues of man and all of these little, you know, quirky sayings, early to bed, early to rise, and all that. And he apparently did get up pretty early every morning. In his autobiography, you can read his daily routine that started with rising at 4 a.m. daily. You always talk about his air baths, Ben.
Yes, yes. He's a big believer in air baths. You read my mind, Noel. An air bath is what it sounds like. He sat around naked for his personal constitution. Additionally, he was a Freemason, a polymath, and many other things. He was a man of many interests. And throughout his life, from January 17th, 1706, to his death on April 17th, 1790, he changed the world. And a lot of his enterprises were things that would surprise the average, you know, the average high school student. You don't hear about a ton of the stuff he's done. You hear about some of his experiments into the nature of electricity and lightning.
Yeah, and apparently the whole deal with the key tied to the kite is probably a myth entirely, right?
Yep.
But he was credited as inventing the lightning rod. Mm-hmm. But today we're talking a little bit more about his little lightning rod.
There we go. And the lightning rods of his friends. See,
that's right.
One of the things that you may not learn in a middle school or high school history class about Benjamin Franklin is that he was also a real Lothario, a crazed womanizer, a sex fiend.
You could even refer to him as a bit of a rake.
Yes, yes, an uber rake. Because he had there's so many different directions we can go with this, but we know that the founding fathers at this point in time have moved into the realm of myth in many ways. Noel, I love that you point out at the beginning of the show that the key story is, you know, is probably a myth.
It's sort of like Boy George Washington, you know, not telling a lie and chopping down the cherry tree and all that.
Or wooden teeth. They were actually ivory and bone.
Exactly.
But in the case of Benjamin Franklin's sex life, we have documentation that proves not only is there some sand to the scandalous stories about this man, but he also advised people on their own sex lives. You see, that excerpt that we began the show with is from a real-life letter that Franklin wrote in 1745. The name of the letter is Advice to a Friend on Choosing a Mistress. And this is, again, a real letter. It's strange because we also found that 40 years before the Revolution even got underway in 1729, Benjamin Franklin was also a publisher, was reputedly publishing a tabloid newspaper that had an advice column about things that would be considered unmentionable in a lot of higher realms of society.
Yeah, that's right. And by the time his autobiography came out, it was pretty heavily censored because late in life, he was absolutely honest about some of this stuff. But because of that already approaching mythical idea of the Founding Fathers, they wanted to protect that legacy and make sure that you only remembered Ben Franklin for Poor Richard's Almanac and for Early to Bed, Early to Rise and for being this model of virtue, studiousness, and steadfast goodness. But Franklin himself acknowledged that he was, in fact, a bit of a lech. He actually said this of himself in an often censored passage from that autobiography. He said, quote, "The hard-to-be-governed passion of my youth had hurried me frequently into intrigues with low women," here's a kicker, "that fell in my way." Yikes.
Oh, and then he also added, "which were attended with some expense and great inconvenience, besides a continual risk to my health by distemper." As far as we know, and we may not know all of it, this guy throughout his life ended up having, what, 15 illegitimate children?
That's what they say, yeah. And if he was around today, this guy would be a Me Too nightmare.
Yes.
I mean, big time. He was well known, not just for being a lech, but for being a lech for underage, potentially, women. He even, there's a rumor that he carried on a relationship with a daughter and her mother, Margaret Stevenson, and her 18-year-old daughter, Polly. That was a little bit probably on the older side of some of his dalliances with young women.
And there's a little bit of a paradox here. Well, let's back up and say you're right. In his final years, as he was aging and after Polly's husband had passed away, he moved her to Philadelphia to live by his side until he passed away in 1790. But this guy also tried to sleep with his friend's mistresses.
That's right.
And as we will find, despite the rumors about his interest in younger women, he went on record several times saying that he actually preferred older women in his correspondence, and like in this letter that he mentions.
And we'll get to that. The reason is a little bit more functional, like long term. He's saying older women might be better for the long haul. But there's even a little, I guess, a verse, a mini poem kind of that's thrown about the time of referring to his time in London and Paris and his reputation that he developed. And it said, "Franklin, though plagued with fumbling age, needs nothing to excite him, but is too ready to engage when younger arms invite him."
And that came about, believe it or not, folks, when he was in his 70s.
Bonkers.
Yeah, so this was sometime after he had written this letter. He was well known for having what people would describe as an insatiable libido or sex drive. And let's go back to this letter when he was writing to a fellow named Cadwallader Colden, which is a fantastic name.
Incredible. Mm-hmm. Mr. Cadwallader Colden.
And he recommends for, as you said, some ostensibly practical reasons that Cadwallader consider choosing a, not a mistress, but choosing a wife who is older. He says, "If you will not take this counsel and persist in thinking a commerce with the sex inevitable, then I repeat my former advice that in all your amours, you should prefer old women to young ones. You call this a paradox and demand my reasons." And then he outlines seven fairly articulate reasons, but they're all stuff like, I don't know, it sounds pretty brutal. Number one, we can just give the gist because these are kind of long. Number one, he says their conversation is better. Like, they're more fun to talk to because of their life experience.
Mm-hmm. And they are more likely because, here's the problem with Ben Franklin, and this comes up time and again, and you can probably already tell, he's a bit misogynist and a little problematic.
You think?
Yeah, because some of these things are very condescending to women, mm-hmm. where he says once they cease to be handsome, it's almost as though they will appreciate so much that you're giving them the time of day that they will, like, do anything for you.
Which sounds like a lot like Dennis Reynolds in Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
Exactly. Yeah, it's pretty bad. They'll take care of you when you're sick. They'll, you know, make you little cakes and soup. Mm-hmm. I'm editorializing here a little bit, but it sure seems like he's trying to give this guy advice of how to get like a nice like maid will also have sex with him, because he also points out age don't mean nothing in the dark.
Danny DeVito's character, Frank Reynolds, has a quote about that that we're not going to put on the air. But if you know, you know. The third thing he says is that there's no hazard of having children. Then he says they're more discreet, again, because of experience. So they're not going to blow up your spot if you're trying to TLC-style creep.
One thing we haven't mentioned, another pretty gross little fact about Franklin, is that he was, in fact, married. He had a common law wife by the name of Deborah Reed, who, like Tony Soprano style, he just cheated on her constantly throughout the span of their 44 years of marriage. And also, as we know, he spent a lot of time abroad as a European ambassador, specifically in London and France. So 18 of those 44 years, they lived apart. And apparently she, during one of those overseas trips, she had a stroke, and Franklin didn't even come back to Philadelphia to see her. And she died alone in 1774.
Which is a shame any way you look at it. To continue these reasons of his, he mentions, I think, Noel, you were alluding to number five when he said, this older woman that he's describing may not be as attractive, per Franklin. He says the face first grows lank and wrinkled, then the neck, then the breast and arms, then the lower parts continuing to the last as plump as ever, so that covering all above with a basket and regarding only what is below the girdle, it is impossible of two women to know an old one from a young one. Here's the line I think you're referring to. And as in the dark, all cats are gray, the pleasure of corporal enjoyment with an old woman is at least equal and frequently superior, every knack being by practice capable of improvement. That's pretty gross. That's one of the things that leads some scholars to say this letter is satirical or right. comedic.
Yeah, he was a well-known practical joker mm-hmm. and a satirist.
And he also, we haven't mentioned this yet, he also never sent this letter.
That's right.
He wrote it. We know he actually wrote it, but it, for some reason, was never sent. What are some of the other things he named?
He also, again, doubles down on that whole, like, you're doing her a favor kind of vibe. Says he almost, like, tries to characterize having an affair. Because, again, this is talking about a mistress. He's not talking about taking a wife. Because he basically starts the letter off saying, you should get married. It's the better idea to get married because that is the most natural state of man. Where he compares a single man to one part of a pair of scissors, and a useless tool. And that, you know, in order to be truly happy and fulfilled, you have to have a wife and have that other part of the scissor. But he says, but if you're not going to do that, here are some tips on how to get you the best possible harem of mistresses, presumably, right? So, again, virtuous to carry on an affair with an older lady. And he characterizes it as such. Quote, they are so grateful, while saying it's less sinful to sleep with an old woman than it is than the act of, quote, debauching of a virgin, which he characterizes as being ruinous to both lady and gentleman.
Yeah, and then his seventh point, the penultimate point, is that the compunction or the regret or sorrow is less. It says, if you have made a young girl miserable, it may give you frequent bitter reflections. You might feel bad about it later. But in this way, you will make an older woman happy, which is, again, I know I used the word earlier, but it fits. It's kind of gross, right? And he's got one more point, which I think you mentioned earlier, which is they are so italicized grateful, which just stinks. And then he closes the whole letter saying, that's my paradox, but still I advise you to marry directly, being sincerely your affectionate friend, Benjamin Franklin.
Yeah, Benny Franks.
So this advice, you know, this is something you and I have not talked about yet when we're off air. Do you think this letter is sincere, or do you think it's some draft of a comedic device?
I tend to think that it's sincere.
I do too.
Given what we know about him.
I hate feeling that, yeah. Because he, as you said, his libido was such a driving force in his life that later he himself came to feel terrible about it. But he was also known for trying to feel up almost any woman he found attractive.
Oh, yeah.
And he treated his wife horribly. His biographer said that he had, or one of his biographers, a guy named Albert Henry Smith, said, "It is no use blinking the fact that Franklin's animal instincts and passions were strong and rank, and that they led him to the commission of deplorable errata in his life, and that the taint of an irredeemable vulgarity is much upon this man."
Oof.
I know. And this is back, you know, in the early
1900s. Irredeemable vulgarity.
I know.
Oh.
And we're harping on this, but it's important that we're not making a hit piece on some American hero, but it is crucially important for us to acknowledge that this person was a human being and not just some airbrushed ideal of early America, which, you know, not to say that he didn't do some amazing things. It's just that he did a lot of horrible things. And when scholars tackle the question of whether Franklin was being comedic or serious, they go back to context clues, whether the letter was delivered, what other kind of stuff did he write. He, for instance, wrote an article about flatulence.
That's right.
Called,
what was it called? The title? Like the glorious fart or something like that?
Fart
or?
Proudly.
Fart proudly, yeah. And that was satire, right?
Yeah, that was satire. But that was satire with, I guess, a cause, because he was saying it's a natural act. Don't be ashamed of it.
That's right.
And he had some hypocrisy going on there too, right?
Oh, big time. I mean, in so many ways. Again, like in Poor Richards, he really tries to, I don't know if he's trying to do it for the sake of vanity or whatever, but he certainly, all these aphorisms are meant to be these virtuous ways of living, these kind of the Tao of Ben Franklin kind of things, you know? But he even characterizes sex as a very utilitarian thing, referring it to it as something that should never be done for pleasure, that should only be done for procreation, you know, for the greater good. But obviously, he did not practice what he preached in that respect at all. And he was even, there was rumor that he was a member of the Hellfire Club, which was a group of aristocratic men who potentially engaged in, like, orgies and, you know, all kinds of crazy shenanigans.
Yeah, and those rumors, I think at this point we still have to say he may have been involved, but those the circumstantial evidence was pretty strong. We also know that he was a hoaxer. He was a troll for fun. Can you imagine him in the age of the internet? I'm having a tough time. He also was known for doing all kinds of weird experiments. He had electricity parties when he wasn't holding orgies. He invented his own alphabet.
We did a whole episode on that one.
Yeah, we did.
We sure did. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Check back on that one if you want to hear more.
Mm-hmm. And I think we talked a little bit about some of his inventions, not all of which were amazing. He had we mentioned this in a previous episode. He did make bifocals. He did make the Franklin stove. That was his first invention. He made the glass harmonica, which quickly got a bad reputation due to the lead in the glass.
Oh, but this is a really cool instrument. It's got like a rotating drum kind of situation where it's like beveled glass orbs, almost like you'd think of a Christmas decoration.
Like glass bowls.
Glass bowls, but they're all joined together. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's the same idea as playing tones from a half-filled or various levels of water in wine glasses. You rub your finger around it, it creates a synthetic vibration. But they do still exist. And if you Google it, you can find some concerts of classical pieces being played on a modern-day harmonica.
Yes, which will not poison people who
Correct,
play it.
Of course.
This is such a ghostly, distinct sound. Casey, if you could you play just a short clip of that so everyone can hear the music?
Thank you.
Perfect. That's some spooky stuff. Oh, Casey, by the way, while we've got you here, do you think this letter was sincere or meant in jest?
That's a tough one.
This doesn't seem funny enough to be satire.
It's so hard to say something that old from such a different time. But yeah, it's probably mostly sincere, I would say. Mm-hmm.
Which is oof.
Yeah.
Also, Casey on the case.
We have the verdict.
So, as mentioned in a previous episode, he compiled a list of 200 plus very specific synonyms. If you heard our previous episode, then you may know what we're alluding to. We would like to introduce you to the return of Ben Franklin's 200 plus synonyms for being drunk.
Oh, I adore these.
I never get tired of these.
I feel like most of these work really well if you say them in a Cockney accent.
All right, give it a go.
I'll just do a handful. Let's see. And then we can switch off. He's had a thump over the head with Samson's jawbone. He's bridgy. He's cat. Chagrined. Capable. Crapped. Cherumbilical. Cherry Mary. Womple cropped. Cracked. Concerned. Halfway to Concord. He's taken a chirping glass. Got corns in his head. A cup too much. I don't even know how to say this one. He's eat his copper. He's crocus, catched. He's cut his capers. He's been in the cellar. He's in the cups. Non compost, cocked, curried, cut, chipper, chicory, loaded his cart.
Okay, I'd like to do a few as well.
There's literally 200 of them. They're so good. So many.
My favorites are the ones that don't make too much sense in the modern day. So stuff like, I'll do a different English accent. Stuff like, he makes Virginia fence. He's disguised with a Z. He's right before the wind with all his studding sails out. He's been too free with Sir John Strawberry. He's drunk as David's sow. He's seen the yellow star. He's as stiff as a ring boat. His shoe pinches him. He's staggerish. He's polite. He's wasted his paunch. He's been amongst the Philippians. He's contending with Pharaoh. And what I think is weird about that is a while back I cooked up the euphemism that I like to use for when someone's had too much to drink, which was they're very charming.
Mm-hmm. My mom likes that one as well.
They're very charming.
Yeah, my mom's always said that. I love that too. Some of these are just, again, we're going through them alphabetically, but he's eat a toad and a half for breakfast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's...
he owes no man a farthing.
He's as good conditioned as a puppy. He's smelt of an onion, which is... So much of these euphemisms are just all dependent on intonation, right? Oh, he's going to Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm. He's got the gout. He's had a kick in the guts, been with Sir John Goa, been at Geneva, globular, got the glanders.
He's been before George.
Oh, before George. Oh, George. He's top been, heavy. Yeah.
I don't know why he's apparently Ben Franklin was trolling some people. I like to think that he had a friend named George and he was trying to make fun of him by making a figure of speech.
Well, I don't know. Now, that's a question I wanted to ask you, Ben. Hmm. I feel like this is sort of an anthropological experiment where he's overheard these in various pubs throughout his travels and he's documenting them.
That's the official explanation, but some of these feel styled upon.
I would agree with you.
You know? Yeah. So let us know what your favorite one is.
A lot of biblical ones. Going to Jerusalem, been to Jericho. Mm-hmm. My favorite, most straightforward one is he's intoxicated. Yes. He's had too much to drink.
Did you see Nymtopsical? He's Nymtopsical.
That's like some Seuss stuff right there. Right? That's
isn't
crazy.
It? Or Oxycrosium. So none of this, despite the fact that we both obviously think this is hilarious, none of this mitigates his overwhelmingly gross activities with women.
Yeah.
In his letter, which is pretty short, you can read in full online, his letter does, it sounds like to all three of us, come off more sincere than coming off as a satirical piece. You know what I mean? And thus ends the story of one of Ben Franklin's most famous or infamous unsent letters. But this does not end our show. Noel, I propose that we take a trip into a segment we haven't done in a while.
Listener mail?
Sounds great, man. What do we have?
Our first listener mail comes from Christine C., and it is in regards to our Tooth Fairy episode. Christine writes, "My kids had the worst Tooth Fairy ever. She was consistently late. After a while, she started leaving notes explaining why. Little notes written with pink or purple gel pen. One fairy was fighting in a civil war. One was in drug rehab for a fairy dust addiction. There were many others. I remember one of my daughters actually gave back some of the money to help these derelict tooth fairies." Love the show, Christine. That's really funny.
That's great. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for writing in. We have received some great stories from everyone about their own tooth fairy experiences. Here's one from Mike T. Mike T says, "Gentlemen, enjoyed the episode about the tooth fairy. Didn't realize how recent that entity is. Since you asked, I had a fairly unorthodox approach to interacting with my daughter when she started losing teeth. This was about 8 years ago. Instead of money, she got a poem under her pillow. The poem was purportedly from the tooth fairy, and they were centered around the tooth loss. I still have a collection of about 5 or 6 of them on the computer, The Lost Teeth Chronicles. At some point, our daughter actually wrote a letter to the tooth fairy trying to figure out why she wasn't getting any money. She was pretty upset about it. I think she still has the reply from the tooth fairy in her drawer somewhere. Anyway, thanks, Mike." So it sounds like we have a lot of parents who are taking an innovative and original approach to the tooth fairy story. I think that's pretty cool.
I do, too. And it was not something that I really considered. But why not? Make it your own, right?
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And since this practice is fairly recent, who knows? The practice that you invent with your loved ones may become the dominant thing. You know what I mean? A few decades from now, people may be getting tooth fairy poems instead or tooth fairy correspondence instead of quarters or nickels, or however it works out with inflation. I'll have to check the episode out again. This concludes our listener mail, but not our show. Thank you so much for listening. Please tune in for our next episode when we uncover what may be one of the real life inspirations for the tale of Rapunzel. In the meantime, you can find Casey, Noel, and myself all over the internet. We're on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, all that jazz. We've got a community page where you can meet our favorite part of the show, your fellow listeners. It's called Ridiculous Historians. And if you want to find us personally on Instagram, we can help you out with that too. I am at Ben Boland.
I am at Embryonic Insider. Big thanks to our super producer, Casey Pegram, as always, Alex Williams, who composed our theme.
Yeah. Oh, I was just hype-manning you for those.
Well, I know you are a big fan of all of these folks, as am I. And of course, our research associate, Gabe.
Yes, thanks so much. And Noel, thanks for hanging out with me as we dive once again into, you know what, I feel like we did something important in this episode, but I can't resist going back to those synonyms for being drunk.
Oh, I know. They're just too much fun.
If you have a made-up synonym for being drunk, go ahead and send it to us as well.
Yeah, you can also just do that at ridiculous@howstuffworks.com. We will see you next time.